Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here, and I have discovered a fun new escape from the daily grind. Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has hundreds of social casino-style games and it's all free to play anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So get to ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
This is Hidden Tillers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
Nancy Guthrie, 84 years old. In the dark hours of February 1st, somebody got into her Tucson home, left blood on her porch, and took her. And there's still no body, no arrest, not even a name. But a note went out to local TV stations claiming she was dead, buried, and with nature. So here's the puzzle. How does anyone charge a murder with no victim, no suspect, and the only confession sitting in a TV station's mailroom? This part takes the prosecution's side, whether that one untraceable note is enough to carry the case. We're going to talk about what prosecutors might be looking at right now with no body and no suspect, but still starting to put building blocks in the case to go after somebody. Joining us to do just that, Eric Faddis, defense attorney, and Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the counterintelligence behavioral analysis program. Eric, you were once a prosecutor, so let's put on that cap for a moment. No body. She's been declared legally dead, but nobody's found her. She has not been declared legally dead. If you're the prosecutor, where do you even start building a murder case when you can't put the victim in front of the jury? And is that wall as tall as everybody thinks? What's going on right now in terms of considering how they're going to go after whoever they find?
Gosh, you know, Tony, in theory, a prosecution does not require the victim's body. That's not an element per se that has to be met. But I can't think of a case in recent memory where the prosecution has gone forward on a homicide charge, didn't have the body, and still got a conviction. Just cannot fathom it. It's just too difficult to rule out other potential explanations, to rule out an accident, to rule out that she did this to herself. Of course, there's no significant indication of that, but just these are things that you have to rule out when you go to trial, and you cannot, in practical sense, rule those things out without the body. So I'm sure they're frantically searching, you know, the desert to try to find something. But that'd be a tall order for sure.
You know, with all that's going on and the heavy caseload that prosecutors have, law enforcement has, and we've talked about this numerous times before, you know, we have the stack that's this high and you have the bandwidth to do about this much. In reality, how much do you think the prosecution or prosecutors involved right now with this case, actively engaging agents on the grounds, directing them on what they're looking for? So I'm going to do two parts in there. How actively do you think they're actually engaging with law enforcement, and actually how much direction do you think they're giving law enforcement?
You know, I certainly think that there is a concerted effort among prosecutors and law enforcement entities to try to reach some kind of resolution, some kind of closure of this case. But how much is going on right now? I mean, it's sad to say this case has gone cold, you know, what I would imagine is that they are trying to search for the body, which they've been doing since the very beginning, of course. And we're talking about a broad landscape, you know, unforgiving terrain, infinite possibilities where this body could be found. So certainly drones, cadaver dogs, there are tools at law enforcement's disposal. But for them to be successful with those tools hasn't happened yet, and it's looking rather grim.
If you're the prosecutor in this case and you're watching where we're at with everything and what's been playing out over the last 5 months, how horrified are you? not just at, obviously, this is a sad, horrible case, but horrified at the investigative work, horrified at Nanos and everything he said, horrified possibly at some of the steps of the FBI or not steps of the FBI. I mean, there's a lot of holes in this that are already gaping, it seems, at least, you know, from those of us who've been analyzing it. And certainly, you know, some of them sound pretty big as we talk about them on shows, but are they in reality when it it comes to prosecuting a case. If you're sitting there and you're watching this, are you thinking, oh, God, even if we do get the person, is this going to be a get out of jail free card for them because of all the missteps? Or is it too soon to really go down that road?
I fear that we are at the end of that road. I fear that even if they were to find the body and develop evidence sufficient to charge a defendant, that there have been so many missteps, so many errors on the law enforcement side that it could foreclose the possibility of a conviction. Look, as a prosecutor, you know, you need law enforcement to be helping you. Getting a case beyond a reasonable doubt across the finish line in a homicide context is hard enough without being stymied by the folks on your own team. And so when that happens, you know, little missteps here and there can be explained away. Everybody's human and you can, you know, make the jury realize that. But there have been some pretty cataclysmic problems in this case so far, and that's going to spell trouble even if they do find a body and find a defendant.
You know, one of the things that a lot of people don't understand so much, I think, and I didn't either until you start working on these cases, is the amount of direction that law enforcement does get from prosecutors, because law enforcement can't do anything with a case unless there's someone who wants to prosecute that case. So there's a lot of collaboration going on there. And there's a lot of direction then that the prosecutors are telling law enforcement, hey, we need to focus on this. I need this, this, this. It would be better if we had this. So what kind of things as a prosecutor would you be looking for directing law enforcement? Do you think, again, just what we have public knowledge, because we don't know what they're doing behind the scenes, but what kind of things do you think the prosecutors are directing law enforcement and or FBI to go after that help might help build that case they don't have right now?
Yeah, Robin, I remember being in that role, and I was working hand to hand with those folks. You know, we have each other's cell phones, and we're talking about the case, and you know, I'm going out to the scene, and I'm saying, hey, we need to do some more forensic analysis of this piece, and we need to acquire a search warrant for this device, and things like that. And so I'm sure that they are directing it, especially in terms of search warrants and production of records requests for apps, for digital devices, including for any Guthrie devices of the victim. Sometimes that can shed some kind of light if you know, she was being harassed, or if she was if there was someone who had, you know, friended her on all these social media things, who's a stranger and who's making, you know, weird comments. They're just, you have to leave no stone unturned. And it's a collaborative effort for sure.
And one more thing on that too, has either of you been surprised? And it just popped in my mind a few minutes ago. I remember I covered a lot of the prison breaks that happened in the last couple of years. And I remember the one up in Pennsylvania, Cavalcante, I think the guy's name was. And one of the things that the state police did really almost immediately is they brought in the Border Patrol agents, and they brought in their human tracking capability with their dogs. And not just, because there's different kinds of dogs that do different kinds of skill sets. And they use all the Customs Border Patrol assets for finding people in trying to locate, you know, the escapee at that time. And then they've used in other areas. Has anyone been, it's like, I haven't seen it reported anywhere. I just did a double check that they're actually used that resource. Are either of you shocked that we don't know of them actually using that resource here? And Eric, have you seen them use that kind of resource? And is that useful doing prosecutions?
Yeah, no, I've seen those resources be used in the appropriate circumstances. And there are even more non-traditional things, Robin. You may have seen, you know, clairvoyance and people who have claimed to have a sixth sense there. So, you know, I imagine they are exploring every possible opportunity.
Well, I will tell you, I did the research on the clairvoyance once. That has been zero cases, zero, where that actually helped find someone.
I remember an Unsolved Mysteries episode, Robin, in 1988, where they solved it. And Robert Stack said it's true, and he was wearing a big old trench coat walking through fog, so it must be true. but yeah, I mean, at this point, I don't know.
I'm just surprised they haven't, because there are so many, there's so many skills and tools and techniques that experts in a specific niche have. And you would think, if you have a situation that, again, that we have on the outside looking in, where you have someone who can do both a porch guy and as well as a human being that used to live in a house that apparently completely went poof and vanished in the middle of the night, you would expect different resources to be on the ground, but additional resources, which are low effort. I mean, that group is very used to tracking people across desert.
I was just kind of shocked. Anyway, I digress.
Eric, what's your take? I mean, not necessarily from a legal, I mean, maybe there's a legal perspective here too, but what's your take on the revelation, I should say, of the second note? Because this is old news, but it's new news to most people because it was not public information. The buried with nature now note. And there's, as with everything in this case, there's 50 different sources saying, well, this note says buried with nature, says there's apology. This one says there's not. Let's go with the note that says buried with nature. What's your take on it? Does this track to you? Is this something, if you were a prosecutor, you're like, that must be the person who took her? Or is it, I mean, it certainly is an abnormality in any sort of case like this. Like, that doesn't happen. Very rarely do we ever get an I'm sorry, she's with nature now type note. I mean, I don't know. What's your take on it as a person and looking at it through a legal lens?
You know, it's a good point, Tony. And I think we have to kind of interrogate the potential motives behind that note. You know, it could be someone who just wants attention. It could be someone who is trying to further orchestrate some sort of extortion plot and wants to throw people off of the trail. It could be someone who, in fact, did engage in some sort of kidnapping that got botched, things went south, and this person's dead. And now they sort of want to tell the cops, hey, you guys, like, be easy on this. You don't need to keep investigating. It's over. Please don't come catch me. So, you know, I think we need to assess kind of what those motives might be for whomever authored that note.
Does it affect let's just go down the road for a second and let's pretend or theorize that the person who wrote that note is the person who had Nancy Guthrie and she died in their possession. Does that note affect anything when it comes to charging this person of the seriousness of the crime if, in fact, she is dead? Or is it just more noise? It's great that you put those extra toppings on the sundae and you feel shitty about it, but at the end of the day, you took somebody and she's dead. You're responsible. Does it weigh anywhere in that equation?
Potentially helps the prosecution because if they're pursuing a homicide case, you've got to prove the person's dead. Even if it appears pretty darn likely based on the circumstances, this person's probably dead. That's not always enough for jurors. You know, people do crazy stuff. I'm not saying Nancy Guthrie did this, but perhaps, you know, people in other cases have left their entire lives and went to Ecuador. And, you know, you just have to sort of shore up any sort of loose end. And this note kind of does that with respect to establishing the death, assuming its credibility.
Mm-hmm. What does this look like as a case if it turns out to go down the theory that I've been talking about the last week, of they went to the wrong house, of if the gem guy, we've talked about that, the guy who was collecting gems, neighbor, literally, you could throw a gem from her house and hit his house. They're that close, literally neighbors, literally, sometimes a Google pin drop away, or sometimes Google puts the pin on the wrong house. That happens too, which I could see like, oh, this is how they got the wrong house. If it was the wrong house, and it was not an intentional kidnapping, not an intentional murder, but it ended up being an intentional kidnapping and whatever happened to Nancy. Does that affect how this is prosecuted if they're able to say, we were actually going after the gems, this went horribly sideways and we made horrible choices along the way? Is that murder one? Is that murder two? Is that manslaughter? Is that something else? How does that look?
Yeah.
It is probably touching on this legal concept called transferred intent. So if I intend to shoot person A and that person ducks out of the way and I shoot person B and I get charged with a murder for person B and I say, whoa, I never intended to kill that person. That's crazy. This is a big mistake. It's a big accident. I'm not off the hook for murder because of this idea of transferred intent. And that idea can translate to kidnapping, could translate to burglary, could translate to a high level felony where they intended to go to house A. Instead, they went to house B. That doesn't somehow absolve you. And in fact, that intent carries with you and would connect to what's called a charge for felony murder, which is where someone dies during the commission of a high-level felony and the perpetrator is on the hook for that death.
Yeah, so let me help me understand. I think I got it, Eric. So if
we'll go with Tony's theory, and I think it's equally plausible as everything else we've been seeing so far, because we've always been, I'll say him and I, more on the track, if we're looking at laws of probability, that this was, well, one of the options is a intended burglary going for jewelry that went sideways with, and she died as an accidental result of a burglary of something they're looking for. Now, if it wasn't the porch guy's hands that killed her, in other words, she saw them, he encountered him, had a heart attack and died, and panic escalation, again, all low probabilities, I know, but there's still a probability, and he removed her body because of that panic escalation, but was not actually the cause of her death. Is that murder that he could be charged with, or is that homicide? In other words, how would that flush out if that's what they were going to go for as a defense?
It's a good question, and it reminds me of a similar hypothetical in which a person is eluding police. They're leading police on this police chase, and things are speeding up, and all of a sudden there's another vehicle, and things go awry, and that other vehicle gets struck, perhaps not even by the defendant, perhaps by the police, and that person dies. That defendant is still on the hook for that death, even though they did not directly cause the physical demise of that person. They caused the circumstances, the criminal circumstances that created the environment for and gave rise to this death that happened. And so I would think that under a felony murder theory, which is usually a class one felony or class two felony, one of the highest, that even under your hypothetical, that person would be responsible for that death, even though there were some accidental circumstances that actually killed the individual.
So that would be murder, not manslaughter?
It could also be charged as, I think it would be felony murder, which is usually a murder charge, but could they charge it as manslaughter, as being negligent and some death happened, being reckless and some death happened? I think those theories are also viable.
Interesting. Thank you.
I mean, if they do catch somebody, I'm sure the prosecution's going to go in swinging hard, maybe even higher than the charges should necessarily be. And the defense is going to come in swinging, going, no, it's not quite what you're saying it is. And that's going to be the crux of the whole case. If we get there, if we get somebody, that's our next line of conversation here. Your thoughts on that first part in the comment section, Substack, YouTube, wherever you're listening or watching, press subscribe and give us your thoughts. Let's flip it around. Same case, Nancy Guthrie, same evidence, but this time we're hunting for the holes, and the investigation has left plenty. The crime scene was so loose that a reporter, Brian Anton, and his photographer walked right up to the front door because he was waved over because he's a great reporter and a wonderful reporter, and there was nobody saying don't. And there was no tape up saying don't. The cadaver dog searches got shut down early. The sheriff who ran the whole thing has a perjury referral sitting on the state attorney general's desk. So the question here is ugly but fair. Did the investigation already wreck the case against whoever ends up being blamed, guilty or not? That's what I want to dive into deeper from a defense perspective, not the horror of the DA and the prosecutor going, this is going to be fun, but from the defense perspective, how much of a cakewalk might this be or not? I mean, the sheriff who ran this swore under oath, Nanos, he'd never been suspended as a cop. Then records came out showing he was more than once. His own county referred him to the AG for perjury. Obviously, not at all connected to Nancy Guthrie. This happened decades ago. But if you're the defense, what does that give you about everything in this case, if anything?
Oh, gosh. You know, if I'm defense, I'm having a field day with that. I'm starting my opening statement with something like, you know, horrible judgment, fatal mistakes, perjury. You think I'm talking about the defendant? No, I'm talking about the police in this case. Like it is so glaring in terms of how it affects the credibility of the investigation, that even if they do reach a suspect, even if they do find a body, I think that there are so many chasms in this investigation into which reasonable doubt can fit. And I think that the defense will be very well postured.
So, Eric, on the same sad track, they made a number of SWAT raids early on as well. does that play into the lack of credibility of law enforcement that defense will use, or does that get ignored? Like, how does that play into it as well? So,
SWAT raids of the Guthrie House?
No. So they thought they had someone, and they rolled out lights, sirens, you know, code one down the street to the house, and they're like, "What? Who are you? Who are the Guthries?" In other words, they went to houses with some real false leads. Does that play into their credibility also, or is that just kind of par for the course for the types of cases like this?
Yeah, for sure. And I think we're going to get into that even more deeply. But, you know, one thing I'd say is to the jury, you know, when law enforcement marshaled all of these personnel and they got all these SWAT vehicles and they're going to this house and they really believe they got the guy, you know what? They believe so much that they had him then. They have that same belief now for this guy. They were patently wrong then. They're patently wrong now. You cannot believe any sort of position they're taking in terms of who they think did this.
Okay, let's do that again. I want to put a spotlight on you, and then I want you to have like a staff or something, and then let be real dramatic. Let's do that line one more night.
That's good.
Because yes, I like that. I mean that's true. I mean it seems very, very scary for whoever did this. If in fact they do catch the right person. They have fairly good odds here. The reporter, Brian, who walked right up to Nancy's front door because he could, internet sleuths were wandering the property. The crime scene was not secured in the very early hours, the very key moments where you need it to be secured. What the hell was going on in those conversations between Nanos, between the DA as they're looking at this? I mean, I can't imagine anybody with any sort of sense is like, oh, this looks like it's going swimmingly. I mean, I what the hell do you think is happening on the legal side and the law enforcement side? It feels like there's quite a disconnect. I know you said, you know, and a lot of times you got each other's cell phone numbers, you're working hand in hand. Does this feel like this is a hand in hand operation with the local DA and Nanos?
You know, it does not. And usually when there is a homicide, at least when I was a prosecutor in Colorado, we would go out to the scene and we would be, like I said, we'd be on the same page with law enforcement. And if we saw something that was problematic, like, hey, you haven't secured this scene yet. Hey, you haven't developed a perimeter. Hey, there are people just walking in and out of your perimeter here. That's problematic. It's going to be a problem for the evidence later on. You got to stop that. That's the kind of communications I would have. I don't know if a prosecutor was not present or if one was present, they didn't see any issue, or if they did see an issue and didn't want to speak up, and or if the sheriff was sort of taking the reins and said, hey, don't worry, I got this. Like, we'll handle this piece of it. You guys do the courtroom stuff. I'm just wondering if some of those issues came up.
I mean, I'm not going down a conspiracy route here by any means, but it almost feels like this was a crime scene that was intentionally contaminated. I mean, I guess on the outside it feels like that, but as a defense attorney, Eric, and as a former prosecutor, how often from the legal standpoint do you look at this and kind of feel that way about cases where it's like, guys, come on, this ain't your first rodeo. It's not like you arrest them and they're in jail forever. There's a legal component to this. Can we get our shit together and not destroy the scene? Is that just kind of more common than we want to admit to ourselves out here as lay people?
You know, I remember a case, Tony, when I was a prosecutor and I was sort of naive and green. I had all these rosy notions of the system being for justice and they're always doing the right thing. And then I was assigned a third DUI case, and the defendant was a police officer. It was a third DUI. And I'm looking at the case and I'm saying, God, they didn't even do these roadside maneuvers right. And they kind of just like called it in. They didn't do anything in detail. They didn't document things well. They gave the guy every sort of pass they could have. They didn't do the chemical test advisement correctly. That they didn't administer the test correctly. Ultimately, it was refusal. But at that point, I realized that investigation had been botched and they were covering for that guy, is my sincere belief. Can't say that's happening here, but I can say that happens. And I've seen it.
You know, everyone's been talking about how the speed and lack of speed that Nano's involved the FBI in this. Again, it's not FBI's jurisdiction, but as a supporting role, there's a lot of resources that were ignored and not utilized early on in this, crime scene handling being one of them, potentially, as well as DNA labs and all that. But now on the legal side, prosecution side, how quickly are you expecting when a homicide like this happens? Like, in other words, what goes on behind the scenes? Do you, as a prosecutor, are you reaching out for law enforcement right away, or you hear it in the news and you're waiting for them to be contacted? In other words, do you think there's a delay involving the prosecution or prosecutor as well? Because, and my only question in this is, like, they needed loving critics on this that they did not have to help direct, you know, some chaos on the ground. Now, granted, we know that Nano's removed his lead investigator. It was a more junior person has put on lead on this. And so if you're having that, you're looking for some objective help and, you know, someone from the outside to help direct this. Prosecutors, how soon did they get involved in these things? And do you think there was a delay?
Highly doubt there was any delay. When I was prosecutor, we would always have someone on homicide call. I've done it a bunch of times. I got called out at 3 o'clock in the morning, and you get up and you go. And so it would be shocking to me if there was significant prosecutorial delay.
Do you think that they did that right away, or could they have stonewalled the prosecutors from being involved like they did the FBI? Or because there's just, you saw all the ground chaos.
Yeah, it's at least possible, but it would just be very unlikely. Most prosecutorial systems, that person's on call, they get that call, they're up and out the door within 10 minutes.
The FBI, Kash Patel in interviews has said they got locked out early on and then brought in. Sheriff's office talking about a key piece of hair that is still being tested all these months later. They tested it at some lab in Florida instead of at Quantico. Now it's being tested again somewhere. I don't know exactly the whereabouts of the hair, and they're trying to figure out exactly what type of DNA to pull off of it. If they can pull DNA off of it, it's taking some time. If let's say we get down to a piece like this where it is just a small piece of DNA. I mean, look at like the Koberger case. You had that little piece of DNA on the knife sheath. This in some ways reminds me of that, depending on what results they end up getting back. How admissible is it if it's been transferred from here to there? Obviously, chain of custody is a big thing. I mean, has this piece of damage or has this piece of evidence already been tainted too much to ever make it into the courtroom? Or do these sort of things happen sometime where the locals send it to their lab and then it goes to the FBI? Does it matter where it goes? Or is this a lot of noise that doesn't mean much?
Oh, it definitely matters. I don't think it is so compromised that it would be inadmissible, but I think that it would be certainly challengeable at the trial phase. One thing that would matter is the meticulousness of the documentation concerning the transfers, concerning the whereabouts, when it happened, how it happened, the packaging within which it was transported. All of those things really matter and can be certainly attacked on cross-examination from defense.
Yeah, to me, I think it's just going to be the delay that it took to get from one lab to the other lab, because labs are pretty much labs. I know everyone wants to go on the FBI side. They should have sent to the FBI. But if they got a relationship with another lab, I don't know how fast one processes versus the others, because then you got to prioritize and it gets messy. But it, like you said, Eric, it all comes down to that documentation, chain of custody. As long as everything was done well, it shouldn't matter, except it's the speed of getting the results as people are running away and getting further away as you're waiting those results. I think that's what was really the hindrance here, potentially.
Whoever, if they get somebody, whoever is caught in this, are they going to have their choice of pretty much the best attorneys in the country? It's not going to necessarily be, here's your public defender. Because, I mean, is this a case where, you know, people are already salivating, where high power attorneys already have their teams working on how they're going to pitch this as I'm your best representative to whoever they may catch? Because, look, we already got the case. We got all this. We're ready to go. We've been studying this from the ground up. What kind of influx of defense support should the person who eventually gets caught, if they get caught, expect?
Totally. So, you know, I contrast it with the White House dinner shooter case, where that's a high profile case, could get you a lot of attention. That case sucks, man. It's on video. The dude's taking selfies with the weapons and everything. Even if you get some sort of notoriety from it, you're probably going to lose and it's going to suck. Whereas this one, the case is super defensible. The case is good. So not only is there notoriety and fame, but there is, people are chomping at the bit to get on it on the defense side because it appears so far to be incredibly defensible. And I would imagine that the top names throughout the country are certainly aware of it and probably would make themselves available for a consultation, you know, at a moment's notice, hop on a plane, they'd be there.
So what would make it more less defensible? Let's again do a hypothetical conjecture here. So say they find Nancy, they find and an autopsy confirms her manner of death. They find DNA on her matching a suspect that they actually capture, but he doesn't confess. Is that still, with all these holes, if you have all those three things, body, DNA and human being that did it, how's that weigh in? Is that still something a defense attorney would take because they think they could still defend it?
Oh yeah, absolutely. You know, the DNA thing, if that were established, would be compelling. But you look into what is the explanation for that DNA finding? Is there any possibility of a false positive? Is there any possibility of the processing being so incompetent that the finding is inadmissible? Is there any possibility of planting evidence? Is there any possibility of some accident, like this person happened to be in the locale at a, you know, they both went to a Starbucks around the same, you know, there are just things that you got to look into. So would not be a nail in the coffin by any means.
In other words, so all the potholes they created along the way have really undermined their ability on the prosecution side to actually have a good case, no matter what happens from this point, correct?
It would seem like that, although it's still potentially provable based on what right. could transpire, but yes.
The question that always comes up, and we're far from getting here yet, but how difficult is it going to be to find an unbiased jury in this case if you're to test it right there in Pima County?
Yeah, that's tough because not only is it, of course, a nationally publicized case, but there's already fame involved because of Guthrie's daughter and who she is. But the prosecution might have some hurdles in terms of finding a fair and impartial juror, due in part to the criticism of the law enforcement and of the investigation. Usually it's the defense worried about, hey, they're going to send my guy, you know, to the gallows because of all this publicity. I think that same concern is on the prosecution side, if not more so.
Well, I mean, it's disturbing. And I'm thinking of that just because I'm watching some of the comments here and there's so many. So much confirmation bias. I mean, I'm watching someone going like, what? Where did you go down this road? Like, how did you get here? And I'm not faulting anybody. There's so much information out there. I mean, unless you're doing this for a living like we do, it's hard to keep track of all of it. So it's very easy to go down rabbit holes or just to go down paths that you think this is legitimate information and it's not. And so people, I mean, my God, this is probably one of the biggest cases where so many people think they know what happened based on somebody else's conjecture that was based on somebody else's conjecture that was based on somebody's conjecture of their cousin's cat, Susie's dog's aunt's caretaker. It's that vast and it goes in so many directions. That's got to be a very difficult thing when trying to select a jury to try and wade into, hey, what do you know about the case? And what is an acceptable amount of knowledge to have on a case, Eric, that can let them be on a jury as an impartial juror without being completely oblivious of everything that's going on?
Yeah. So, really, the metric is not exactly knowledge. So knowledge is a proxy for having an opinion. You have to have knowledge in order to have an opinion. But but a person, in theory, can have a ton of knowledge about reports in a case. And so long as they have not developed an opinion as to guilt, an opinion as to the competency of the investigation. So long as they have just passively received that knowledge, then in theory, they could be let on the jury. But in practice, any human being who has received such knowledge, I think, would instinctively draw their own conclusions.
What? Let me throw this one at you. What if you're interviewing somebody? I don't know how this process works. I've never been a juror. So you're interviewing jurors and they don't have an opinion, but I heard it was this, this, and this, and it's like nothing to do with reality. Insert just totally disprovable bullshit here. And they don't have an opinion, but it's like, I heard about that. Is that like a red flag? Is that like, okay, you're out because you've absorbed this and you're recalling it? Or is that a good juror who's just taken some stuff in, but that seems to be what stuck and it's not remotely part of reality?
Yeah, for me, it would be a tremendous red flag, because what it means is they have a misapprehension about what the evidence might be. And that misapprehension could cause them to negatively view what the actual evidence is. So I would think that would be grounds to strike a juror if they, you know, adopted this.
Adopted and just, I'm not paying attention, but here's what I heard in passing are two different things, though. You know,
I'm curious about this angle.
Yeah.
So I'm curious about this angle when it comes to jurors. I've sat on jury, and my wife sat one last year, and one of the things that's interesting when they're doing all the questioning, one of the cops that made the arrest, actually her kids were where my wife works. And so she knew by default this cop. And so that became a thing that was she's being questioned about. And so in this case, it might not. I'm curious, Eric, what you think, whether it would be disqualifying or not, because I think more people might know about Nanos's reputation as sheriff than they might know about this case because of how contentious he is. Would that be a potential jury question about what they think about the sheriff and his conduct just as sheriff? And would you use that as either a qualifier or disqualifier? Or do you think it'd even come up?
Oh, gosh, yeah. Yes, it would absolutely come up in jury selection. And whether it be disqualifying is depends on the side you're on. It depends on what the answer is. But if I'm prosecution, I'm fronting that. And I'm saying, hey, look, I don't get to choose who my sheriff is, and I don't get to choose what they do. What I get to do is present a case in which I believe strongly where we have evidence of guilt. So you kind of have to soften that how it's going to land for them. And you can do that in jury selection. You can do it in opening statement and throughout the trial. But that issue will be front of mind. And if folks have drawn a conclusion that this investigation was botched or just incompetent or whatever, if I'm prosecution, I'm getting them out of there. If I'm the defense, I'm begging to have them stay.
Yeah. So think about this. His entire conduct is the thing that could, you know, even if they got the guy that did this, his entire conduct could actually completely undermine this entire thing.
Yeah. It's like a potential get out of jail free card. I mean, as close as we can get to having one, really. And that's why, again, you cross your T's, you dot your I's, and you, I think more importantly in this case, it's not even about just crossing the T's and dotting the I's. It's understanding what a T is. It's understanding what an I is and how to use them in a sentence. And I think that metaphorically is a problem that Nanos has always suffered from. Your thoughts in the comments section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in. Let's go to another area of this conversation. Leave the kidnapping behind for now. A whole different set of legal trouble. The kind aimed at the family and the people accusing them. Nancy's relatives were cleared. That still has not stopped strangers online from deciding her son-in-law's bandmate, a grade school teacher, was the masked man at the door and showing up at his house over it. The sheriff himself told the guy to get a lawyer and sue for libel. So this part is about who actually has a case, why nobody's filed one yet, and whether the online mob is about to learn that citizen journalism has a limit that the law actually cares about. Eric Faddis, defense attorney, is with myself and Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, to help us break all this down. Let's go to there. The grade school teacher plays in a band. Woo! Evil rock and roll! That clearly rock and roll music.
The stuff of Satan!
Of course it is. a grade school teacher who plays in a band with Nancy's son-in-law gets tagged online as the masked man at the door.
Devil music.
He was home with his kids. He got cleared. The sheriff flat out told him to sue. Does this guy have the cleanest defamation case in the whole thing, Eric?
Oh, gosh. You'd certainly want him to, and you'd hope that that was the case. But when the alleged defamer is a government official, it's so much harder. It's so much harder to bring a claim against those folks. Certainly, this has all the makings of a defamation case, but for the actor being a government official, which, you know, as we might talk about, goes into immunity and sovereign immunity, qualified immunity. There's all sorts of protections for when the government gets it wrong, and those protections would be at issue.
When you're saying government official, are you referring to the source of the reporter who went down this road?
I'm sorry. Let me clarify. So bring a defamation claim against a police officer or something would be incredibly hard. Bring it against somebody who is not a government official, like a social media journalist or, you know, whatever, citizen journalist. That would actually be a super strong case. You know, you got to hope that there are assets. There's a collectability issue. Mm-hmm. You got to make sure it's worth your while to go through it. But that claim would be tremendously strong, I think.
What about, let's go down this road for a second, of the source that initially this whole ball of wrong came out of, where it was reported. Ashley Banfield reported it. I'm not throwing shade on Ashley. I'm just saying what happened here. Reported that, you know, allegedly there was a source that named Tommaso as the prime suspect. That was then that everybody started running with that. We don't know who that source was. Very shortly after, Nanos came and said, no, that's not the case at all. It's not that. And in no way, shape, or form am I insinuating that that is the case at all. This is just how this has played out. Is there any, or are there any legal repercussions for a source that gives a reporter that information? I mean, Ashley's not a citizen reporter. Obviously she doesn't have to give up her source by any stretch of the imagination. That would be another big hurdle that would happen here. But if, let's just play it out, she gets sued. Does she have any sort of defense? Does she have anything where she can look at that source and go, here's what they told me. I'm the reporter. I'm the messenger, and I'm relaying information. But the source was not delivering it at an official capacity. So as the reporter, you're kind of putting your credibility on the line if you're going to go forward with that information or not. It's a gray area, some may argue. Some may say it's very black and white. What say you?
Yeah, you know, I think the reporters have to, in those contexts, have to choose their words extremely carefully.
Yeah.
If the reporter were to say that this is all according to a source, and I haven't, you know, I don't have 100% confirmation of the veracity of this source's account, but this is what the source is saying. This is a matter of public import. I think the public should know about it. So I'm telling you, I'm relaying that info. Then she's probably protected. Whereas if she said, you know, a source gave us this information and what I'm reporting to you today is that this Tommaso person is the suspect. That is where you've crossed the line. And so the reporter has to be very careful what they say. The source might actually be insulated from defamation, because for defamation, you have to make a statement to a significant number of people that ruins someone's reputation. If you just make it to one person, even though you know that it could be disseminated to a lot of people, is that enough for defamation? That's a weird little wrinkle that a court and or a jury would have to decide.
Yeah, so basically, Eric, does it come to the caveats that are given or not given for someone like, you know, a reporter like that gives? Because, like you said, if you know, hypothetically, we'll just use Banfield, since she said a lot of things about the brother-in-law and her source inside the investigation, she didn't caveat it, just like you said, saying, you know, this is just from one source. This one source reports this. She doubled down a lot. I don't remember exact language.
I don't know exactly how much she doubled down, so I'm going to be cautious there.
Right.
But yeah.
Do caveats matter? That's a good way to phrase it.
Yeah.
100%. It's critical, because when defamation, we're talking about the assertion of a fact. If a person's asserting a fact that is false and hurts a person's reputation, other requirements are met, that might be defamation. But if you are relaying information you received and you're giving the context of, hey, I haven't personally confirmed this, you know, things like that. So yes, those caveats are critical.
It's kind of an easy way for everybody to understand it. Is there a big difference between going on the air, okay, here's the news, and the report is, a source is telling us that so-and-so is the prime suspect in this investigation. It's a hard news piece. You're delivering. It's not a conjecture piece. It's not an opinion piece. It's not an interview piece like us, like we're doing here and having a conversation. When it's hard news, it's one thing. The way it was delivered, if I remember correctly, again, I respect Ashley. She's a great, I'm good with her. She's a great person, a good reporter, and shit like this does happen. When you have something like that, when it becomes more of a conjecture piece of a source is telling me, and then you bring on guests and you discuss, and it is a conjecture discussion. But it's based on information that you're treating almost as a fact, because it came from a source. Is there a difference there? Is there a difference in how that is discussed, and how it is portrayed? Because, I mean, at the end of the day, people are going to take away almost the same message, whether it's a hard, straight news piece or someone having the conversation, maybe even more convinced that there's legitimacy to it because of the conversation that goes on around it.
Sure. Yeah. You know, in the context of defamation, what can be problematic is the assertion of a fact. And so is the reporter saying X is true, or is the reporter saying a source claims X is true? And then when you have a more elongated discussion about it, another thing that comes into it is opinion. You know, if you're talking about your opinion, like, hey, I think there are grounds to lend some credibility to this source because of these circumstances, because of X, Y, and Z. Did you think about this? I think those are opinions, and opinions are not defamation. It has to be an assertion of fact. And so I think in the hypothetical you're giving, you're allowed to have such a discussion, talk about hypotheticals, talk about likelihoods and probabilities. But when you get to that assertion of fact saying this is the guy, that's when you've got a problem.
Yeah. Yeah. A bunch of people have been calling the family killers, and not one lawsuit has been filed as of yet. Obviously, that would be more in the civil realm. And, you know, you got to have something to collect if you're really going to go after anyone civilly. Otherwise, why are you doing it? Are you surprised that there hasn't been any sort of civil lawsuits filed as of yet? I mean, against anyone. I mean, there's errors in reporting, but then there's also just the cesspool of conspiracy theories that are out there that are really vile and really have. I mean, they've driven people to show up at some of these people's homes, some of the family's homes and friends of the family's homes, because they're so citizens think that they got the person. I mean, no lawsuits have been filed as of yet, as far as we know. Are you surprised by that? Or is it just like that just stirs the nest, you know, kicks the hornet nest even harder?
I would anticipate, if not lawsuits, at least some legal action, like cease and desist letters. If there was somebody popping off on some platform and they're spouting falsehoods, and that's having somebody show up at my family's home. We got a problem, and I'm going to take legal action. I wouldn't be surprised if there was some degree of legal action taken, even if it didn't get to the lawsuit phase yet.
I'm curious about that cease and desist letter. You know, I hadn't even thought about that again until you just brought it up. How would that work in this situation, and how effective could those actually be? And are there any teeth to them?
Yes. I mean, a cease and desist letter in part is a threat. It's saying, hey, stop what you're doing or else we're going to sue you. Now, that threat has teeth if there is a reasonable likelihood that a person's going to follow up on and file a lawsuit. If there is no such reasonable likelihood, or if the individual spouting off doesn't have anything to lose, then you know those might be less effective. But I think the standard person is going to get a little spooked and say, "Hey, let me focus on something else."
Are you surprised we haven't seen any of those? Or heard of any?
We haven't seen any publicly, but that doesn't mean they haven't been transmitted.
Right.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
I mean, we have seen calls go in to Pima County about some of the amateur streamers that are out there. Basically, you know, being a nuance and obstruction. They say they're doing citizen journalism, standing in front of an empty house of a missing, murdered woman. You know, I don't know what the hell that is. That's really not journalism. I've never seen that's I don't know what the hell that is. Voyeurism is more what it is. But yeah. I mean, and so we've seen, you know, and they're like, it's my right to stand here and do this.
Stalking.
What about that? I mean, where's the actual line between standing on a public street, covering a case and crossing into something that prosecutors can actually, you know, lock you up for?
Certainly one line is the property line. You can't be on someone's property. There could be a trespassing issue there. Mm-hmm. There are laws against stalking. There are laws against harassment for repeated contact with no legitimate purpose. You know, would there be a defense that, hey, yeah, this my purpose is I'm doing a cool Facebook post about this, maybe. So I'm not sure how much protection those folks would have other than they could contact their local law enforcement, and law enforcement would probably be able to place reasonable time, place, manner restrictions on that journalistic activity, saying, hey, you can only do this during reasonable hours during daytime. You can't do it at 2 o'clock in the morning. You know, there are ways to circumscribe it, but to stop it entirely, that's tough.
Yeah, just look at all the people that were outside of Rex Schumann's Ellerup's house forever. So yeah, it's,
well,
that's
I
a
guess
rough
you
one.
Know what is a journalist today in the eyes of the law, and does it matter? I guess because anybody can be a journalist. I mean, it's not like I'm gonna go get. Basically, it means going to Kinko's and getting something that says press on it, and boom, you're a journalist. You have a YouTube channel. You're a journalist. You work at the TV station. You're a journalist. Is there a line anymore? Considering people get more of their news from YouTube than they do, you know, the local TV affiliates.
I think that that change has really broadened who can be a journalist, what journalism is, and probably for the better. You know, I think that for the longest time, there were just these, you know, really narrow aisles from which we got sort of processed information and sometimes sanitized everything else. This has broadened that. It has led to some headaches as well. It's led to some inaccurate information. It's led to several maladies. But on the balance, I think that it's a good thing. And I think the law regards it, you know, I don't think the law is in the business of saying, yeah, that's real journalism. No, that's not real journalism. I think the law is in the business of saying, what right do you have to do what you're doing? And I don't know that the definition of that role is super necessary.
I did my thing, as I did. There's no federal or state licensing requirement to call yourself a journalist. The term is protected under First Amendment. And then shield laws protect journalists from being forced to reveal confidential sources, but they don't say what those journalists actually, how to define them, right? Press credentials come under that, but again, that's only for major events and IRS and tax purposes. It has a legitimate occupation that you put down, but it's self-employment can do that. So it's literally, there's no legal definition that keeps someone from saying they are.
I think this is a business opportunity for all of us. Just like people open up companies that do like life coaching, where it's like, we're going to certify you as a life coach. I'm going to certify you as a journalist. All you have to do is 72 payments of $29.95 and you're going to get the journalism life coach course. And you too can be a journalist that camps out in some front of someone's house and screams into the air. Just think, all you have to do, 72 payments of $39.95, and we're going to send you that lanyard. But wait, if you call right now, we'll send you a second one for whoever else you want to deem a journalist as well. You know,
you say that so smoothly, it just blows my mind. Now he's going to be selling a slap chop next.
By 5 o'clock tonight, I'm going to have certified a lot of journalists. All right, your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in and give us your thoughts. As always, thank you, Eric, for being here and giving us your thoughts and your insight on this case. Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, as always, thank you. It's Not All About Me is Robin's latest book, available wherever you get books. Go get it and leave a review as well. Until next time, for Todd, for Eric, and Robin, I am Tony Bruschi. We will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Bubba Wallace here from 2311 Racing. You know what's slower than a pace car? Waiting at the car wash. That's when I fire up Chumba Casino. It turns those slow minutes into fast fun. With new games every week, you'll never get bored. Next time you're stuck in the slow lane, speed up with Chumba. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. For years, Chumba's been setting the bar for online social casino fun, and it just keeps getting better. With new games released every week and daily bonuses to collect, the fun never stops. So claim your welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Drew McIntyre here from WWE. Wielding the Claymore can be a life of chaos. When I'm not dominating in the ring, Chumba Casino is how this warrior takes a wee break. With hundreds of online social games and new weekly releases, there's always something fresh to try. And those daily boosts, next level. Even my free time feels like Valhalla. So when life feels like a battle, kick up your feet, have some fun, and let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here. And if you're looking for some serious fun, head over to ChumbaCasino.com. At Chumba Casino, you can play all your favorite social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. It's the most fun you can have on your phone or computer.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. For years, Chumba's been setting the bar for online social casino fun, and it just keeps getting better. With new games released every week and daily bonuses to collect, the fun never stops. So claim your welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. The rush of racing? Nothing beats it. But Chumba Casino comes close. Chumba's got fast spins, fun games, daily bonuses, and all the action you can handle. Now that's a ride. Ready to hit the throttle? Get in the driver's seat and head to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T&Cs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.